everybody. This is Paul Cram, and you're listening to We Be Geeks.
And welcome to another episode of We Be Geeks. Just like any other week, it's just another normal episode.
But it's our 100th episode.
What?
So I guess it's not normal.
It's a centennial episode?
Centennial. We're now triple digits.
Wow.
This is an episode.
It will test your head and your mind and your brain.
And really none of any of those things will be happening. You just tune out and keep driving as you're listening to us in your car.
So as you're questioning, yes, this is episode...
2, 4, 9, or 5?
No. Tommy has it wrong. It is episode 100.
100. Congratulations, 100. Mike.
Well, thanks.
Because you've actually been here for the entire 100. We, Jules and I, on the other hand, have just kind of jumped in and like, yeah, 100, we did it. And we're like, yeah. Really didn't do all of it, though.
Well, true. Marty, you've been here for half of it.
This is true. This will be my 50th.
This is your 50th.
Okay.
The one episode, a little trivia fact for those that don't care. The one episode that I do not, I'm not heard on, which is the interview with Duke Boy.
John Schneider.
That one, I was originally on it, and we had a technical snafu, and we had to record on another day when I wasn't available. So it was in spirit on that episode. I'm counting it, but I wasn't actually on it. So 49 logged podcasts that you can go and listen to.
But 50 you're on staff for.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. And Jules, I'm trying to remember, which number did we snag you in on?
I know she came in August.
Yeah.
So that's
like, August.
Was that like 80 or 79 or?
Seems like it. Somewhere let's track that down. We'll have to get the geek staff to figure that out. the crack team of number crunchers. There they are. They all sound like 1970s Hanna-Barbera computers, but hey.
Oh, that's one group of geek number crunchers we have. The other group. And those are the speedy ones.
So since you've been here since day one, this is your baby, Mr. Emke. How's it feel to actually hit 100? Did you think when you started out doing first couple episodes that you'd keep doing it for what is this 2 years in the making now?
2 years in the making, yeah. Actually, I think initially I was kind of going, I hope we hit 7 episodes.
What was so special about 7? Was that just when you figured that that's when you're going to know if you want to keep doing it or not?
They always say with podcasting, if you could get through 7 episodes, mm-hmm. then it's a routine. You're going to keep going.
Yeah.
Whether it's a monthly thing, bi-monthly, if you hit 7 episodes, your chance of survivability it is improved.
Gotcha.
And then when Ken left, I'm like, okay, I know the bugs hit me. I'm still going to do it. I think I did a couple episodes by myself. Then I found, through the help of Weeby Geek staff writer, Vicky, she helped me find Eric, who was on for 20-something episodes. And then he moved on to go do his own show. And through the help of friend of the show, Al John, he hooked me up with Marty.
And, I mean, not only is he a friend of the show, he's now part of the We Be Geeks Network with Walt Disney World After Dark.
And WDW Tiki Room. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, we are all one big happy family now. We found Jules just, standing out on the street corner with a sign saying we'll podcast for comics.
Well, it's interesting. Yep. We had talked, Marty and I had talked that, it was like, numbers are good and everything's doing well. I'm looking at my meters going, okay, never mind. I'm seeing two different things on my meters. Numbers are doing well, But, you know, we gotta think about a third chair. And when we did, we said it can't be another guy. It's gotta be a female voice. And
voice of reason is what we needed.
Probably that too. And I think a lot of it was, you know, just the female voice is it's a different frequency range just to help break up the monotony of two guys talking. And things happened to work out that Jules was available. And the funny thing is, I actually went to Jules and said, do you know someone who's might be interested in doing the show? And then she comes back a couple weeks later. What software do y'all use? You know, I really want to get podcasting. I'm like, you want to come sit in on a show or two and we'll see if it works out? Of course, we did induct her into the tribe. two or three shows into her sitting in. And yeah, it's rest is history. I mean, everything's
here we are.
Great, and here we are.
So. That's a really huge feat. Like I will say, you look at a lot of the podcasts out there, and there's thousands of them. Right. You know this, and
hundreds of thousands of them.
Right. We appreciate every listener that does give us a try, whether it's been in the early days, the latter days, current days, the whole run through. We do appreciate everyone listening, and you know, hopefully we're getting bigger and better, and you guys are liking this more instead of less.
And for those listening, as this releases today on Thursday, one more day to enter that contest. Contest ends Friday. If you're listening Friday and you didn't enter the contest, well, shame on you. That's all I got to say. You should be sitting there going,
oh, man. Rejection. How I missed you.
So,
yeah, let's see that. All right. So for the last minute, people, for the 100th episode, quick run through of the prizes.
Three hardback books valued about $40 each from Valiant. Two hardbacks from Zenoscope valued about $25 each. A MemoBot power tube, I believe it's 16 gig R2-D2 MemoBot USB drive. I'm sorry, it's a Mimico power tube, not MemoBot. MemoBot's the USB drives. A set of four books, The Zone Continuum from Bruce Sick, and like six or seven DVDs and Blu-rays from Partners Hub.
All for one lucky listener.
All for one lucky listener.
And just go to the website at weebiegeeks.net and you can get yourself logged in.
Actually, it's Facebook through the Facebook page on the giveaway on the Facebook page. So, I mean, you tell me what other podcast outside of the bigger names like Adam Carolla, The Nerdist, Penn and Teller, do they have prizes valued like this? I mean, I'm sure there's some out there, but you don't see many.
We're not at Oprah level yet. We're not giving cars away just yet. You get a car! You get a car!
Maybe a Matchbox car.
Yeah.
Hot Wheels.
That's probably Batman related, just because that's how we roll.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power.
So, I mean, it's a great prize pack. Go check out our Facebook page. You got, a little bit of time if you're listening to this the day it drops. Cause I don't know. Are we gonna maybe the next time we do one's the 150th episode? That's another year away.
I don't know. Yeah. Might be 200. Ooh. 200th episode.
Get it in now. Might be the last time we give away free stuff.
I think we'll hit another 100 after this.
Okay.
Nice. I mean, hey, look at the history with like the Force cast. Mm. I mean, they went. I mean, with Jimmy and Jason when they were there, they were what, 6-7 years. Yeah, you know, and those guys are still going under their new show, Rebel Force Radio. I mean,
all they're talking about Star Wars. What's happening in that universe now? I mean, nothing. They're just talking about the same thing over and over. They're just quoting their favorite lines from the movies, aren't they? That's all they got. Did you see the article?
Billy D. William quotes the week.
favorite quote, yeah, from other movies that Billy Dee's been in, and Han Solo,
or press conferences.
Right. No, did you see that that release that came out? I think it was today that said that Marvel is estimating that they're going to be publishing, releasing, distributing 1 million copies of Star Wars number one when it comes out next month in January.
Yeah, they're going to have to.
That's amazing. But I mean, of course, part of that, I do think there's about like 30 some variant covers that are going to be.
Tell me about it.
Part of, and some of, most of those are going to be like where a store can go in and have, you know, they're having their own covers made, unique covers to that store. So some stores are going in and going in on the offer. I know Rick's Comic City's doing it. And so there's got to be, you know, probably like, you know, Midtown Comics and, you know, all the, probably the bigger, like, things from other work.
Mile High
like
Comics, yeah.
Right.
Which I'll find out from them when I'm out there visiting and stopping by their store the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, there you go. See what they got. Yeah, because I mean that is huge to think. All right, put in this perspective, like a million copies, that used to be pretty commonplace when like X-Men number one, when Jim Lee was doing it in the 90s. That was pretty commonplace. That was the one that sold like the most ever for a comic book at one time. And that was, I can't remember what the final number was, but like a million copies was like doing really good for a launch. And then, you know, of course, you know, recessions hit, things like that. Nowadays, a really popular book sells 200,000 to 300,000 copies. Mm-hmm. So to actually say a book that hasn't even released is going to do five times that already, and you know, that's just early speculation, and that's just being what's distributed. There's probably going to be more demand. It's amazing. It's mind-blowing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, when I put in with my local store, hey, I like the book on my pull list, and I would love to get one, you know, get a variant cover. They're like, which one? and us even asking you which one, we can't even guarantee that.
Yeah.
You know, we'll try and get you a variant, but we can't guarantee you which one you're going to get.
Yeah.
Okay. And then just to keep reading, you know, all these different variants that, you know, every store is going to have. Like, for that person who wants all the variants.
Oh, yeah. They're going to be plunking out some change.
Just give up now. Just give up now.
Because there's some 1 in 100s that'll probably be your easier ones to get. I think there's like a 1 in 300 or 1 in 500, somewhere along in those lines, where it's going to be like an astronomical amount of.
Well, and how many covers is Rick's going to get?
They'll get the one cover that's unique to Rick. That's the thing that really makes it interesting, because they've had other covers like Afterlife with Archie, and, you know, the new adventures of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, or Chilling Adventures, like this. And what they do is they have like one cover that's a store variant, and then they just put that store logo, the same, you know, whatever the store logo is, in the same place for every store. This one's going to be very unique, where, like, you know, Rick's Comic City's cover is going to look exactly, you know, different. It's going to be different than Midtown. It's going to be different than Mile High. It's going to be
every one of them will
have their own unique. And that's, you know, ambitious. But it's actually kind of cool too for the collector, because it's not just, you know, oh, this logo is different in this spot. It's a fully unique cover.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it so nice, Jules, that Marty said he's going to be getting us each one of those covers?
That is extremely nice.
You do have an inside pipeline to this, so yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you guys know if any of the stores near you are participating in that program?
I don't know.
I'm curious to see what, because I mean it's a pretty good price, and I can see like some of the smaller shops not being able to really you know, dedicate that much money to one book. But
I would have to check with my local store, see if they're doing it.
Yeah,
but
I don't know if ours is, but we have like one that we go to that gets every single comic, every single variant, every single everything. It's kind of far. It's like 30 to 40 minutes away. But I mean, they just have everything. So we might try to go there if we can't find it. Cause I know Ron, like he orders, like, if it's going to be big, he'll order some, but he won't get all the variants. I mean,
it's hard. Yeah. So. Cause you know, you gotta think, if you're going to get a 1 in 100 variant, that means that shop's got to order at least 100 copies, mm-hmm. which shouldn't be a problem, I think, in selling it. But
Well, here's my question. My next question, the digital copy, will that have at the end of the digital file, all the variant covers that were made?
Possibly, maybe.
I don't know.
That's going to be like a 175 page $3.99 book.
Do they do that with some of the other books that come out? Where they have variants, so they'll tag them on at the end?
I don't think so.
I haven't seen variant covers at the end, but I've seen extra. I've seen like some of the art pages at the end. Hmm. So I mean, they could do it, but yeah. I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, they can easily do it. I mean, because it all gets usually transferred.
Well, I see on Comixology they'll sometimes soliciting like a digital exclusive or digital, you know, addition or something like that, but it never says actually, it never details what that digital extra is. It just says it and tends to be like, I find it on a lot of Valiant books for some reason when I stumble upon those.
Dynamite as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just a term that I should be familiar with and I am not, but just because I don't deal with a lot of digital myself personally. I'm the old paper guy. I like it on
analog.
Paper.
Good old analog.
I know. My nerd room would probably wish I would go more digital because it's filling up. But
yeah. So speaking of filling up, did y'all get a chance to fill up on The Walking Dead?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was delicious. All them intestines.
Well, at this point in time, we're just gonna call it out.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, that's a cute spoiler alert.
That one was an older one, too. Oh, my Lord.
So she can't even say spoiler. It's so cute.
When did we record that? I don't even remember.
So just giving you a heads up, if you're listening and you've not finished the 8 episodes of The Walking Dead.
Spoiler alert.
All right. Then you don't want to get mad at us for ruining it. I don't know. What you want to throw in, like a time? Like how much time we want to give to this? 10 minutes?
Yeah, let's do 10 minutes.
9 minutes. Like 9 minutes is bigger than 10. some great difference there.
10 minutes? 5 minutes?
2.5.
Hey, Tommy, what do you think?
2, 4, 9, or 5.
Tommy's getting a lot of airtime tonight. You put 6-pack of cola in here?
Possibly.
Anything you want to keep... go ahead.
So Walking Dead, what did you guys think? First half of the season. To me, I think this is season 5? To me, this ranks up there with the first half of season 3. Yeah, it's been fast-paced. When it does slow down, it doesn't stay slow for long. Since we've already disclaimed the spoiler, and we said, you know, give us about 10 minutes, Jules is happy. I don't know about Marty, but Beth is dead.
I'm like one of the few people that I wasn't a Beth hater. I was like, oh yeah, she's kind of useless. She was really good in the prison when somebody had to look after Judith because you know, I don't know, she firmly fit the whole mothering thing, even though she was probably a teenager supposed to be. But I didn't have any hate for her. I was like, oh, she just needs to die off already.
Well,
wasn't the opposite of Daryl, you know, if you know, Daryl is riot like, if she you, doesn't die.
You get your cougar with Carol. Daryl, you get your jailbait with Beth.
Either way, he's gonna. Yeah, it just
he's not happy
now. It helps
make
Daryl's decision easier now as to who he's got.
True. No, I guess I didn't. I didn't hate her, but she just. I don't know. I think she just kind of annoyed me a little bit. But the way they did it, like, see, I don't read the comic, so I don't know if it follows like how if she dies in the comic or whatever. But
I don't think she's in the comic.
She is. She's dead though. She dies. She dies a long time ago. She wouldn't have made it this far in the comics. But there's also there was no this whole hospital storyline. That's all new. That's never been in the comics.
Okay.
So that was pretty cool to see.
And in the comics, Tyrese is already dead. So is Judith.
Yeah. Right. True. Yeah. But I thought it was really. I was actually really sad because the way it happened. Like I didn't expect it. Like I thought it was gonna be. Like I thought she was gonna do something stupid and like get eaten by a zombie or something. But and of course I love Daryl. So Daryl was crying and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't deal with this. So I thought it was incredibly sad. And
Daryl's then I felt not really. In the comic.
I felt so bad for not liking Beth after that happened. I was like, oh, I feel bad. Now I want her to come back. But yeah, she's...
Speaking of which...
I was going to say, I think that was their whole deal. They gave her a really good push, like a send-off, like a, you know, building her up and actually investing mm-hmm. some. Because really, when's the last time that they really invested any storyline time to her? She probably, you know, had the whole suicide scene, back in like season 2 or 3.
Yeah.
That was really, you know, focused on Beth. And then, like, the only other time I can really think of her having importance in the storyline is when they came back and, like, her boyfriend at the time gets, like, eaten or killed or whatever and doesn't come back from a run. And she doesn't even cry anymore because, you know, it's happened so much. She's used to it. And, like, that's the only, like, those are probably the only two significance that I can think of, her participating or carrying on the story. So they really had to do a lot of work to make you care about her before they killed her.
Right, right. Well, it's funny you say that, you know, bring her back. There apparently is an online petition to try and get her back.
Like, what?
She's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the character that people thought, you know, wouldn't make it this far, if it really happened to be a zombie apocalypse, they want her now to bring her back. I guess actually now that title goes to Eugene, so we do still have somebody that would not survive this.
So now potentially heading towards Alexandria and that whole storyline in the book?
That's my guess. For those that may not know or caught up in the reading, Alexandria is essentially like another civilization that's been set up, maybe similar to Woodbury, but doesn't have the tyrannical leader of a Woodbury. Although there will be a tyrannical leader that's not far away from Alexandria, who goes by the name of Negan, which I'm pretty sure that they're tying in Negan to Terminus.
Right.
That's my theory on where they're going. The people that took over Terminus after Rick and the crew got out, I think that's going to be Negan and his crew.
This is what, Morgan, was it, that we keep seeing drifting behind him?
Right. Did anybody catch the, I guess, the teaser at the end of the credits of the last episode, episode 8, where Morgan's like still just kind of following around their path by random?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, that whole scene where he catches up to him happened earlier in the series with Rick instead of, you know, it's weird how the timeline from the books and the show change slightly, but then get back on track, and then
they weave around each other.
It's not
quite, but it's pretty close, so that, you know, hardcore fans kind of know maybe where it's going, but it still keeps them on their toes as to not knowing exactly what's going to be coming up. So that's what I really love about the series, is that I've been reading these books since like issue 36, my first single issue that I got. So it was like already 3 years in. I had to catch up, got to issue 36, and been reading it monthly since. And I'm, every time I'm watching the episode, surprised. I love that.
So what are y'all's feeling about this first half of the season, and what do you hope to expect?
I think for the second half of the season, my guess is that we will see them get to Alexandria and maybe even kind of start to settle down by the end of the season, and then we get the introduction of Negan at the end. Kind of like have that end of season cliffhanger of sorts, or maybe not even a cliffhanger, but just kind of like, this guy's coming up next season. Get, you know, go change your pants right now, because it's happening. It's going to be awesome. Because he's kind of character like sort similar to the governor, where he needs like that a whole season to really just, you know, fall in love / hate with him. Cause he's one of those tentpole characters in the series.
What about you, Jules?
This has been my favorite season so far. I watched season one, then I kind of skipped around. I think I watched all of four. This has been my absolute favorite season, especially since like the way it started. It was kind of just like, oh my God, like I didn't expect it. I thought it was going to be, I know like the first episode is usually pretty like quick, but I was like, it was so great. So as far as where it's heading, since I don't read the comic, I don't really know like what to expect, what's coming up. I've heard of Negan, but I don't know like what his thing is. I don't know anything about him. So, but I don't know. I'm starting to really like all the characters. I only liked a couple. I only really liked Daryl and like a couple others. But now I'm starting to really like Rick. Like, he's really growing on me. I didn't really like him. I thought he was kind of like, I don't know, dorky, I guess. But But no, I think he's really coming into his own, and you're just seeing another side of him.
I think that's the one character that really kind of got super interesting for this season, and mm-hmm. how he's changing in this season is Rick, and like how he's starting to view the world and almost getting lost in it now, because like after Terminus, he's just like, kill them before they kill us.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He had that when they're going through the plan to, like, you know, to get Beth back. His is all like silent and deadly. You know, that's mm-hmm. my plan. We're taking them out, and then we're out of here, and we got our people. And then even with like the scene with the cop, you know, instead of just, you know, grabbing the guy or making him stop, he hits him with a car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then takes him out the rest of the, you know. So it's like he is definitely turned the corner, and I kind of wonder if like the crazy phone's going to start coming back into play, because I think he's going to start to unravel a little bit more, and probably really see a dark Rick coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of dark, things are getting dark in the convention world. You've got some creators saying one thing and others saying another thing. The latest on this is Pat Broderick. He basically came out, I think it was on Facebook. He said, "Today's heads up. If you're a cosplay personality, don't send me a friend request. If you're a convention planner or promoter and you're building your show around cosplay events and mega multiple media guests, don't invite me. You bring nothing of value to the shows. And if you're a promoter pushing cosplay as your main attraction, you're not helping the industry or the comics market. Thank you." And of course, this is coming on the heels of, you know, Tony Harris and then Denise Dorman. And basically, you know, they're just saying, you know, he goes on to say that cosplay are just selfies in costume, and doing multiple selfies is the highest expression of narcissism, and doesn't understand why the hell anyone would pay for a signature on a photo with a cosplay character. Yaya Han, Ivy Doom Kitty, those are the biggest two out there. One more than the other, but I didn't say that. Broderick also cites the same reason as Dorman did behind her rant, that although the con attendance is up, this has not made its way to both the dealers and the artists. Broderick suggests that cons completely separate the media and cosplay guests into their own separate shows, which is an interesting thought.
Which you could say is called Wizard World.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're less comics and more entertainment, media, cosplay. I mean, right. They have like a huge costume contest at every show.
Right. But they,
it's not uncommon for those shows.
They still bring in comic guests and whatnot.
Yeah, but the one in Nashville was thin on comic guests.
What about Artist Alley?
Thin. Like, thin. a man you may know, Michael Golden,
right,
was at ours. Some of the other names off the top of my head. I think McGuire was there. But yeah, just like, I mean, we're talking about like a couple of established names in the industry, and then the rest of them are people that are up and coming artists.
Right. Right.
So yeah, I would not classify Wizard as a comic convention. It's comic centric, but not a comic book convention.
It's more entertainment,
right,
convention.
Yeah. So I mean, in some ways, they are kind of separating, but they're almost doing it. I mean, that's how shows are kind of going. I think they're either seeing it, and most of them, I think, are going to be entertainment, because those are
right,
the higher
right,
draw, higher dollar.
Now, this article that I found this from, they say, you know, other industry pros were quick to jump on the anti-cosplay bandwagon. Raymond Liu, owner of the New York-based Mutaiki Sales, is a anime and tokusatsu dealer, who, you know, they said their best showing was at New York Comic Con in 2012 with tons of cosplayers in attendance, shared a story about a cosplayer in his booth who said he wanted to cosplay Doctor Strange because of the excitement of the upcoming film, but didn't know much about the actual comic book character. Liu kicked the attendee out of his booth. Artist and writer Mike Wolfer has come out and said, yeah, he'll ignore con guests or con invites that proclaim a huge cosplay contest. And then in parentheses, oh yeah, and Stan Lee.
Jeez.
Writer Mark Ellis has added that turning over these events to people with a narcissistic personality disorder in Zombie Number 4 from a 10-second scene in an episode of The Walking Dead does nothing to support comics. And also that he hates, and this is his quote, overweight women in Power Girl and Slave Leia costume, posing, posturing, and demanding $20 to take a photo of them.
Oh, wow.
I didn't charge 20. I charged 10.
Yeah.
And I thought my Slave Leia costume was pretty.
It was okay. There's a couple inconsistencies with it, you know.
See, that's why 10. A guy I know just said, you're standing around in public looking like a fool. Shove your 20 bucks. And took pictures anyway. What are your guys' thoughts on all this? Because I know Ethan Van Sciver said, you know, this is part of the entertaining part of the convention, is seeing them all come around, that, you know, he gets a kick out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering, like, they still are attendees, so they're buying tickets, which in turn supports it, right? I mean, supports the Comic-Con, is paying for that.
Right.
The other thing, like...
Well, except for the pros that are, you know, whatever, the people that are able to set up booths.
That are being paid, right.
Yeah, they're actually paying the convention to be there, more than likely, or having some discount because of some celebrity they may
Or either, I'm sure, something like Yahya Khan. Well, you know what? You give me a cut rate, then I'll do autographs. But someone like Ivy Doomkitty, you know, MegaCon, she was over in the same area as the voice actors. Yeah, you had Yahya Khan who was running her booth. Okay. And I think there were a couple others that were in Artist Alley. It's like, okay, so where does it begin? Where does it end? Because, I mean, you see all the... I know for me, seeing all the cosplays... Star Wars convention? Yeah. The people who cosplay there are still buying stuff off the floor. But, I mean, you're also... It's a focused target audience as well.
Yeah.
Whereas something like MegaCon, Wizard World, whatever... How many of the cosplayers do you actually see while they're in costume carrying bags of stuff that they've bought at the show?
I think I've always been curious, like, how do you become a professional cosplayer? Like, how do you actually make enough money to where that is your full-time job?
Kickstarter.
I know, you know, it's got to be, because to me, it's like, you can set up a booth and do that, you know, sell the pictures or the calendars or whatever other stuff you got to sell, whatever you do. And it just doesn't seem like you can sustain that, any kind of living off of that. But somehow some people do. And that is amazing to me. I'd like to actually find out what the secret is to that.
Well, a lot of these people, you know, they set up their own store on their website. And, you know, some of them, how do they do it? More provocative pictures. And sometimes it's pictures of them not in cosplay. It's just them in lingerie. It's like, okay. I mean, to me, I don't get the whole... I just don't get the whole cosplay. I mean, yeah, I guess technically I'm a cosplayer myself, you know, being a part of Rebel Legion and the Jedi Assembly. Mind you, I don't actually go to the convention dressed. I have yet to go to a convention dressed.
I understand going dressing and participating in costume. That's fun, that, you know, people like that. But I don't think I would ever buy anything. I don't understand, like, wanting to buy something from somebody's booth that's cosplaying. It just doesn't, that part doesn't make sense, because that's not what I'm going there for. I can,
no.
You know, these people, for all I know, these people just did this costume the day before and they're just showing up. I mean, it's, I'm not there for that. You know, maybe there are people that are there for that, but you know, as for them having a booth, it does, you know, the creators are, it's just more money that's getting taken away from them, because you already got the entertainment people that are, you know, pulling the dollars out of the pockets from the creators there, and then you got like another corner that's taking more money away from the creators that are actually making the comics that everybody's going, you know, coming to see the movies and the TV shows for. So, you know, does it help it? Does it hurt it? I guess that's really the thing that a con creator has to look at. Does having a cosplay community or support help your con or hurt your con?
See, the convention wants the cosplayers because they're buying the tickets. It's I think where it's going to hurt the con is if, you know, all of a sudden they're reaching out to all these people and they're going, no, because you got way too much cosplay going on. You got way too much. It's not comic related. No, I'm not coming. It's it's your show's no longer about comics. I'm not coming. I mean, you start getting that, and I know I just sound like I repeated myself three times. Once you start getting a lot of that, it's going to hurt business, because then you're not going to get people wanting to come, you know, the other people. I mean, I would love to know. I would love for 2015, all the conventions to keep track. I have counters there. How many people come in costume? How many people not in costume? And let's get a breakdown on your busiest day. How many is costume? How many is not costume? And see how much of a difference. I mean, let's see how close those numbers are.
Yeah. The other thing too, what if they, like, say a con says, okay, no cosplay allowed. I mean, what's their, I guess that's kind of what you're saying, but what's their breakdown of that? So.
Well, I don't think these creators are like boycotting people. They're just fans dressing up in costume. They're boycotting the ones where you actually get like the top main ones and setting up a booth and selling merchandise for people to dress up in the costumes.
But they're also saying too, you know, Broderick, the way he's talking, MegaCon's not going to be a show he'll ever come to.
Right, well, it's got entertainment guests and it's got costume contests, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So. Plus, it's also got professional cosplayers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like if they say no, like, even like that they won't let them like set up to make money, like a lot of cosplayers are not going to go. So, because they all kind of support each other, you know, it's like they're all a big family. Just like if they said, you know, we don't, which would be absurd, but we don't want comic fans here, like we would all be like, oh no, we're all gonna, you know, boycott Comic-Con. So I don't know, it's just like, it's just a touchy subject, I guess. Like
it's kind of a similar rift of when, you know, it's only like 10-15 years ago when most comic book shows were just that, like dealers in a room with mm-hmm. comics or comic collectibles or something along those right. lines. And then a few of them would start adding like entertainment guest or two, and then, you know, oh, that worked out, that really got people to come in the door, so they'd add more. And I would always hear dealers complain, like, oh, this is getting to be less and less of a comic book show, partly because those entertainment guests were now taking some of the money away from them.
Right.
So, you know, there's that, the whole give and take, like, oh, you're getting more people to come to you, but it's also still taken away. And I think this might be just another source of where creators are like saying, hey, this is getting taken away from us too.
Right. So, right. Well, I know because of other things outside of the podcast. I mean, yes, we do have lives outside the podcast. We're going to lose Jules here. But Marty and I are going to be back with someone else in that third chair just for this show. Someone golden. I'll just say that. And, so I'm going to say personally, Jules, thank you for being part of the show and being part of the first 100 historic shows of Weeby Geeks.
Thank you for inviting me. I've had a great time. It's been good. And I came at the right time, you know, at the end. So that way, 100 episodes. And
should have waited till 101 so you can get in on my contest. That's what you should have done.
Yeah, true. I didn't think of that.
No, that. See, I've already got the title for 101.
Right.
Well, besides it being the best, you know, episode 101 for us is going to be the best of 2014. at work, if we're 101, we're either a ride down or a show down scenario.
Yeah.
So I was like, episode 101, showdown. And then 102 is when we're back to everything is all clear. So
everything is all clear.
The next two
should be everything
named.
Is awesome.
It will be, because it'll be the new year, right?
Yeah. So, well, when we come back, we're going to take a brief break here. When we come back, we're going to have a special guest. So, you're listening to Weeby Geeks, and it's our 100th episode.
Have you ever played a video game, and when it ended, you had more questions than answers? Questions like, what the heck did that mean? Or, why do people hate this game so much? Or even, how can a game be so bad? Video Game Construct is here to answer them. Join Jesse and his co-host Jason as he relates video games to the real world, and together they try to bring some understanding to the meaning of games and how they affect us as players. Find us on iTunes under Video Game Construct, or find us on the web at VGConstruct.com. www.libsyn.com.
Joining us on the line, we have Christopher Golden, author of Snowblind, that just came out last month. Also, we know him from the Mike Mignola universe with Baltimora, other Dark Horse titles like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, etc. So we welcome to our 100th episode, Mr. Christopher Golden. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me on your 100th episode. That's pretty cool. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, we kind of fudged and we said 100 was our golden episode just to kind of make it fit the theme tonight. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
we don't really know. Is there? We haven't. I guess maybe we should invent this for podcasting. But maybe there should be like a, you know, how like in wedding there's the wood, the tin, the gold anniversaries and stuff. Maybe there should be something like that for podcasting.
So what you're saying is every time anybody's podcast reaches 100. Episode, they have to have me on.
Exactly. Hours. I think that's only fair, yeah. Right?
But yeah, that sounds good.
You might be a very busy man coming up. I don't know.
So, like I said, I know Snowblind just came out last month. Tell us a little bit about Snowblind.
Snowblind, yeah, it came out in paperback at the very end of November. And it's actually in development for television right now with David Goyer as a producer, so fingers crossed on that.
Awesome!
But basically, thanks, man. You know, it's sort of a supernatural. I'm going to say it's a horror novel for sure. But I think of it almost like a supernatural ensemble drama, and I don't mean that in the television sense. I mean it in the sort of literary sense. You know, it's definitely a horror novel, but it's about a town and people in the sort of same way that Salem's Lot would be. And basically, it's a situation in which this horrible blizzard comes through. In New England, and a lot of people die, and there are things in the storm, and some people vanish, and then sort of everybody's unsettled about that. So 12 years later, when a very similar storm is approaching, a storm of similar sort of significance, people are very much sort of on edge, and they start to see some of the people who, well, maybe they don't see them, but they start to encounter some of the people who disappeared or died in the previous storm. So that's basically the nutshell version of it.
Cool.
Is that what you've been working on the most here lately? Is that what's been like trying to get it developed, or just getting the series plotted out? What's been taking up the most time?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I spend I balance my time pretty much between the novels and the comics. Right now, I'm working on a novel for St. Martin's, which is a follow up to Snowblind. It's not a sequel, but it's another horror novel called Dead Ringers. No relation to the film, and I've been arguing with them about whether or not we're actually going to call it that. But,
I was thinking name sounded familiar for some reason.
Yeah. And I'm hesitant to call it that, but then again, if people who read the book, it is the perfect title for the book. So it's this war between two sides of my brain. And so basically I've been balancing my time between the novels and with comics. Both with Baltimore and also with another project that's coming up with Mike that has not been announced yet and which I cannot talk about.
Are you sure you can't talk about it?
Oh, I'm positive, but I will say this is the first time I've ever mentioned it.
I mean, I've We Be Geeks exclusive.
There you go. So there is another project coming up, but beyond that, I cannot say. I balance it out pretty much. And actually, the next novel I have coming out is completely different from anything I've ever done. And I did that after Snowblind, and that comes out in June. It's called Tin Men, and it's a near-future science fiction thriller.
Excellent. What got you involved, or what drew you to Baltimore?
Well, actually, you know, I have a long history with Mike. I've known Mike for pretty much my entire career, or close enough. I mean, many years ago, I was an editor and writer for a magazine called Flux that lasted, I don't remember how long, but not very. And I interviewed him for Flux magazine right around the time the first issue of Hellboy came out. Maybe there were two issues out at that point. And I said to him that, you know, there should be backup stories in Hellboy like there were in the old black and white Marvel magazines in the 70s. He said, "I suppose you'd want to write them," and I said, "Of course I would." And that ended up leading to me writing the very first Hellboy novel, which is called The Lost Army. And we've been working together on various projects ever since, almost 20 years. Hellboy just having celebrated his 20th anniversary. But basically, you know, Mike and I would talk on a regular basis, and every once in a while he would tell me about this vampire graphic novel that he wanted to do. And so I knew a great deal of the story over the years, and then one day he called me up and said, I'm never going to be able to do this as a comic. It's never going to happen. So I think that it should be a novel and you should write it. So that's how we ended up teaming up on the original novel of Baltimore. And then the novel came out and did pretty well, and we talked about potentially doing a novel sequel, but eventually we realized that what we really wanted to do was bring it to comics, which is where he originally sort of wanted it anyway. So we're doing, in fact, Dark Horse in a few months, but I can't remember exactly, are actually publishing the novel in paperback for the first time.
Oh, wow.
So that'll be the Baltimore or the Steadfast Tin Soldier and the Vampire, if you want a title that's a mouthful. So we've been working on the comics for a long time now. I'm working on Volume 6, which is called The Cult of the Red King. And, man, this is the place to jump on. For anybody who's heard about it and sort of not been paying that much attention to it or might have a sort of passing interest in horror comics, Cult of the Red King, number one, is definitely the place to jump on. But it also is the place where we really start to set things in motion as we head toward the climax of the story, which we've already figured out, but I cannot say, again, how long it will be before that that comes about. So there are future volumes to be told, but as far as what they are and how many more there might be, I am not allowed.
What's it like working with Mike? We had we got to talk to Scott Ali just a couple of weeks ago, and he was kind of telling his experience with kind of editing with him and writing with him as well. What have been some of the things that he's kind of taught you, or you maybe even taught him over the years that you kind of worked out and figured out?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I first of all, I can't say whether or not Mike's learned anything from me, except I do think, actually, I'll change that second. I'll change that answer in a second. As far as what I've learned from him, you know, the best thing about working on Baltimore, more so than having done the Hellboy novels with him, you know, and I've done also, I edited the other Hellboy novels, ones I didn't write, mm-hmm. and three Hellboy anthologies. So I've worked with him over the years on various projects, but Baltimore is very different because, the beauty of what Mike does is that his characters are constantly encountering strange and mysterious and terrifying and fantastical things without him as a storyteller ever feeling like he really has to explain it or mm-hmm. explain himself. And I'm a plotter, you know, I'm a guy who wants to figure shit out, you know, and there was a huge sort of like weight lifted off my shoulders when we did the Baltimore novel, because I really felt like, well, you know, this is sort of coming from Mike's brain. And while I did invent a bunch of the stuff that's in there, you know, 80-85% of the plot of the story is from Mike, and a lot of the detail were from Mike. And so when, you know, a vampire in one particular scene is killed and his, you know, corpse lands on the ground and it burns in the sun, and a crow comes out of his head, or a blackbird, not really a crow, but a blackbird comes out of his skull and flies away, I, as a writer, normally would explain that. But being that it's Mignola and that we share this love of folklore, it really gave me the freedom to say, no, we don't need to say more than that. And so that's actually really helped me in a number of other projects. I still am an explainer. I still tend to try to go to those places in my own work. But there are times when I don't, especially in things like short stories. And I feel like it's been liberating working with him. You know, and sort of the flip side of that, if he's taken anything from me, it's actually been sort of over the years, back when there was only Hellboy, I think the sort of encouragement to say, listen, people love this stuff more than you think they do, and really there needs to be a BPRD comic book. And him saying, no, you know, we'll never sustain it. You know, it won't work. And going back and forth, and, you know, he wanted to do it, you know, and of course, I'm not suggesting that the decision was made because I recommended it. That's definitely not true. Mike would punch me in the head if I said that. But I will say that I certainly was proven correct. many times over. And so I'm, I don't know, I guess I'm the practical side of our conversations.
Do you think that might come from you being, you know, since you like to write novels, you like that, all that detail, and maybe Mike comes more from the artistic side. So he's just doing it to make, you know, for what looks cool to him, and the rest of it will kind of work itself out. Do you think that might be?
Well, you know, it's funny. He's constantly talking about how he's not a quote unquote real writer. Although finally, I think over the last couple of years, he's coming around to the realization that he is and giving himself, maybe giving himself the credit he really deserves, because right. He puts just as much thought into what he's doing as I do into what I'm doing, and sometimes more, I think. But no, I actually think it just comes from the fact that, you know, I definitely am someone who, not that he doesn't understand, but I'm interested in both art and commerce. Mm-hmm. And Mike tries to stay as far away from the commerce part of it as possible.
What's been, outside of Baltimore, your favorite, Mineola verse? I know I just butchered that, project that you've worked on.
I've enjoyed editing the anthologies that I've done and editing the novels that I've done, but there's no question that I did three novels. The first one is The Lost Army, the second one is The Bones of Giants, and the third one is The Dragon Pool. And the second one, The Bones of Giants, is certainly the favorite amongst readers of those three, and with good reason. I think it's the best written one. It's the one with the most imagination, and it was the most fun for me. Basically a bunch of researchers find the actual corpse of Thor on the coast of Scandinavia, and Hellboy eventually comes to investigate and actually grabs the hammer to pick it up, and it fuses to his left hand. Excuse me, the right hand. I'm tired. Anyway, so it fuses to his hand, and he basically gets the power. And there's way more to it than that. There's Valkyries and giants and all kinds of weird crap. And that it was just so much fun because I've been passionately in love with Norse mythology since the fifth grade.
Do you find it at all, like, as far as fans go, or maybe crossing over platforms, like a difference between maybe the novel crowd and the comic book crowd? Is it hard to kind of cross-pollinate those two sometimes?
Is it hard to marry them? To try to get the comics people to read books and vice versa.
Right, yeah, yeah.
There is obviously a natural sort of Venn diagram in this. There are definitely some of the people who read the novels, read my original novels, do read comics, and some of the, and vice versa. But, I actually feel like it is sometimes a struggle to get the comics people to pay attention to the books and the book people to pay attention to the comics.
Right.
I think
a lot of that came from, I remember growing up and I'd see like some novel sitting on the shelf of Spider-Man per se or something like that. And you read it and it would be like some just sort of kind of a fluff piece in regards. Just it didn't really fit in any kind of continuity. It was just kind of this random story that was out there and. Kind of felt like it was missing the pictures kind of deal. So I know, not saying that any novel or all novels are like that in that are retaining to, comic book characters, but I do remember growing up wanting to read those and then being really disappointed. So I didn't know if maybe some of the mindset has changed from people as far as reading a novel based on a comic book character.
Yeah, frankly, look, I'm not going to beat around the bush. A great many media tie-in novels are absolute crap.
Right.
There's no question about that. And I think that sometimes you have media tie-in novels by otherwise talented writers that end up being crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think often there are many reasons for that. Sometimes it's about the timing, how long you have to write one of those, but. A lot of times it's about writers who are just trying to make a living, who are taking a job to write within the confines of a property that they really have no passion for.
Mm.
And that's a huge mistake. That's a huge mistake. I've been offered, I'm not saying all the media tie-in novels I've done are fantastic works of literary genius. That's definitely not true. I'd like to think that most of them are pretty good. And some of them I think are things that I would hand to anybody, whether they were interested in the property or not. But certainly there have been a few that were not genius, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. That said, you know, I've taken on things that I love, things that I'm passionate about and fan of before I do them. I don't have to sort of pretend with it. And I've turned down things. I, way back at the very beginning, when CSI first came on the air, I was offered a long-term contract to do CSI novels, and I turned it down. James Cameron's Dark Angel JAG, for some insane reason, people came to me and wanted me to write JAG.
Did you ever watch the show, even?
I think I had seen an episode or two, you know, but those sort of procedural things are always sort of pretty boring to me.
Right.
And so, you know, there are lots of things I've turned down over the years because they just weren't for me. So I think what you're talking about is, yeah, I mean, I think that if you're, you know, if you're not passionate about the thing that you're writing, it's going to show.
Right.
So, you know.
Now, when you did the novelization for King Kong, how does something like that work out? I mean, are you given like a synopsis of the script or the movie?
You know, you had no idea what you were getting when you asked that question. So the story behind that. Yeah, so the story behind that, well, not juicy so much as amusing. I'd never done a novelization before. I'd done lots of novels set in the world of existing property, but never done a novelization. And I campaigned for it. And they went for one other person ahead of me who was, you know, probably rightly so, certainly more marquee value to the writer that they went for, who they couldn't make a deal with. And then they came to me. And I was very happy about it. And then I found out what the deal was. And the deal was that, the only copy of the script in North America was in the office of the president of Universal Pictures. And they wanted me to write a novelization of a movie without me seeing the script.
Wow. I thought you were going to say they're going to ask you to break into that studio and get the script.
Well, that, you know, in a weird way, they offered me a certain amount of money, and then I said, listen, I'm going to have to go to L.A. You know, Universal agreed to let me sit in a room, sort of basically under guard with the script and quote unquote take notes on the script. And so I basically said to them, look, you're not going to find me out there, and they said no. All right, then you have to increase my advance on the book at least enough for me to pay for my hotel and my airfare. And they agreed to that. So they paid me more, and I bought my own plane ticket and paid for my own hotel, and I flew to L.A. and stayed in a hotel right next to Universal Studios, and I spent 3 days in a tiny little room at Universal Pictures. And in the morning, somebody would come over from the office of the president and deliver the script to the room, and I could not leave the room with the script. And I spent 3 days transcribing 180 pages of Peter Jackson's script. I transcribed the entire thing.
Oh my God.
And wow. came home with it on my laptop. So there were two copies of the script in North America at that time. But the thing is, how idiotic is that? I mean, have you ever heard anything stupider than that? Did they honestly think anyone could adapt an entire movie without having the script, without having access to the dialogue? And, you know, like, it was the stupidest thing I'd ever seen. But, of course, it's just friggin' bureaucracy.
Well, I was just saying,
they had to be able to tell.
Wasn't that the rumor for, was it Men in Black 3, that they started shooting before they actually had a completed script? So that none of nobody knew on day one.
I think they finished shooting without a completed script.
Exactly, because that was a disorienting movie. It was not well done. So they were basically expecting you to pull Men in Black in novel form.
Yeah. Yeah, they just, you know, I, so.
And it would have saved everyone, how much would it have probably cost for them to just, like, copy and fax that versus flying you out there, boarding you up for 3 days so you can actually sit there and type it all out?
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous.
I mean,
But Universal would not relinquish a copy. Wow. They weren't allowed. I mean, the script was, what they do in those cases is that the pages are actually read, so they can't be copied. And the name of the president of the studio was, across every page. So that even if you managed to somehow copy it, the name of the president was on the script. Wow. So they would know that it was that copy.
Wow.
But it was in my laptop, you know. If I'd been that kind of guy, I could have blown the whole thing. Like, I could have just posted it online, but I've never. I think those people are appalling.
Did that teach you anything doing any more work for film and television in the future, or even in the past? Have you gotten to where you've just gotten used to that sort of idiocracy?
It's always an adventure. You know, I mean, it really, like, any time you do one of these things, you're going to run into one form of stress or paranoia or bureaucracy or another, and you're just going to. And so I do very little media tie-in stuff these days, but weirdly enough, I had two of them this year. One is the prequel to Aliens that I did, which just came out, which is called Alien River of Pain. And the other one is the Sons of Anarchy novel, Bratva, which is out right now and selling ridiculously well. I only wish I had royalties. but it's a weird thing because, you know, people think, like on Sons of Anarchy, you know, people think that the book is selling so well and I must be making so much money, but, you know, media tie-ins are very often things that where you know, you just pay the flat rate. It used to be that you would get some royalty for it, but now that's a rarity. So you have to do it to love, you know. It doesn't make any sense for me to take a job where I could, you know, if I wrote something original and wrote it in that same time frame, long-term, it's a much better investment of my time. But, you know, then I have to contend with the 15-year-old version of me who is unhappy if I say no to certain things.
Talk about that, where you're mentioning like how much probably the book industry, both comics and novels, have changed over the last 20 years with like technology growing and you know, distribution channels changing. How much more difficult would you say it is now than maybe when you started?
Well, look, I mean, it's always been hard to make a living in this business. I'm 47. I quit my real job in 1992, so 22 years ago. And at that time, I was married, but I had no kid and no mortgage. And I can't imagine doing that as an adult with a mortgage and children and just saying, sure, I'm going to make a go of this. I've got a couple of contracts. What the hell? I'm going to try. I'm going to go for it. It takes enormous balls at any point, but it takes, like, at these days, unless you have some serious momentum and serious cash and you know, it's crazy. I think I tell people all the time, you know, maybe it's a good idea for you to keep that job and just write on the side.
is it harder to get like the money that there was? Is it I mean, do you have to take on more jobs? What, do you just be smarter about what you invest your time in?
I think I don't think I've ever spent enough time, as much time as I probably should have. And maybe that's for the best for my sanity, thinking about, you know, what would be the smartest strategy long term. Mm-hmm. I sort of gravitate toward the things that interest me. And I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to sell a lot of things that if you wanted me to predict whether or not it would sell, I would probably not even try to sell it. So I've been really lucky in that sense. But that said, you just never know. Weirdly, 2014 has been probably the most successful year for me ever. And 2015 is looking pretty good. I don't know, knock on wood right now, because you never know. So I don't know. I mean, I think that it in some ways is much harder than it ever was, because just like the American middle class is failing, the publishing mid-list is failing. You know, if you're not at the top of the list, if you're not being published prominently by a publisher, then it's hard to make any money or make any headway. So yeah, it's an ever-changing situation. I hear a couple of good things though. One of which is that the defection of readers from actual physical books to ebooks has plateaued. So I don't know what the percentage is, but it seems like the bleed away from physical books has stopped. There's a new wave of independent bookstores opening. So ebook sales continue to rise without any further bleed of total readership from physical copies. So all of those things bode well for a stabilization. It's definitely a really crappy way to make a living. I would say, when people ask me about it, I say, you know, it's the best and worst way to make a living. But I've been supporting my, you know, it is. I mean, I've been, right. You know, yeah, I mean, my commute is literally like 8 steps. you know, and yeah, and I'm home every day when my kids get home from school, and you know, all of those things are great, and I've supported my family doing this for over 20 years. All of these things are great, but it's also an incredibly unstable environment. You go through incredible cyclical changes. You have a couple of years that are phenomenal, and you have a couple of years where you're just, you know, in the abyss. So you just never know, but you got to hold on.
Now, when you're writing, how hard is it, or what's the transition like, going from writing a novel to then writing for either a graphic novel or a monthly periodical, comic-wise?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So, for instance, I'm also doing a trilogy of graphic novels with Charlene Harris, who writes the Sookie Stackhouse novels, which the HBO series True Blood was based on.
Right.
So Charlene and I, we've finished writing the first two. The first Cemetery Girl book came out in January. Second one should be out, I'm going to say, well, I can't put a date on it, but it's soon. I mean, it's the artist is very close to finishing, so I mean, it really should be springtime. And then the third one, the script is almost done. So, but the weird thing is that there is no transition for me. Never has been. When I'm under the gun, like I am right now, like tomorrow morning, I will be doing revisions on the first issue of The Secret Project with Mike at the Dark Horse that I can't tell you about. And then in the afternoon, I'll be working on Dead Ringers. In between, I'll be responding to a bunch of emails and following up and writing notes for proposals that I'm working on. And, and so I still have to finish Cemetery Girl. There's always, and I'm editing an anthology, and, so I'm always working on four or five things at once. And I don't really know how to do it any other way. During the times when I've been able to just focus on writing a novel, I'm actually happy. You know, it does seem to work better. It's easier to do it that way, no question. But my sort of ADHD creative brain just can't do it. You know what I mean? Like, when it happens like that and I've got the luxury of it, I enjoy it. But then I have six ideas for other things that other projects and various genres and mediums that I just, I need to try to pursue. So, and then things come up like, Mike and I did this novel together called Joe Golem and the Drowning City. And it's being developed right now by Alex Proyas, the director of I, Robot and The Crow and Dark City. And Alex did the first draft of the script, and then he went off to make this movie called Gods of Egypt, which is coming out, I think, next year. And so while he was off doing that, Mike and I are also producers on the film. I wrote a bunch of notes to the president of the company. He had written some notes to us, and I responded to his notes with notes of my own. And he said, geez, I really like all these ideas. While Alex is off shooting, I want you to, do another draft of the script, like basically do a pass on Alex's thing, which never happens. You know what I mean? It's like the idea that, that's the kind of thing that, like, writers would laugh at and think I was completely full of shit, because that's, Hollywood doesn't do that. It's only, I think, because the guys at Comptine are not American. It's a German company. And they're practical, they're not thinking about it in that sort of anti-writer way that sometimes comes up so much in Hollywood. So to him, it made complete sense that the guy who wrote the book would have some insight. So the idea that you'd hire someone like Alex to write the screenplay and then bring in the original writer to do a pass. Now, Alex is going to do another pass, but, that kind of stuff they just don't do. But my point is, when you get that phone call from the president of the studio, you don't say no.
Right.
You don't say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm too busy working on my other deadlines. You say, yes, when do you want that?
Because even Hollywood is kind of feels like they've kind of taken a bite where they're not launching nearly as many projects as they used to. They're all kind of focusing on like a couple big budgets and maybe a couple smaller ones, but it's mostly a lot of pennies in one bank kind of deal these days, it seems like.
Yeah, I will say that sometimes they seem to learn a lesson. Like right now, as you guys know probably as well as anybody, almost every studio is trying to develop its own sort of version of the Marvel success, right?
Right.
And they're just trying to develop these huge shared world franchises that they can just milk forever. And by the way, I think the Marvel movement, by and large, fantastic. But you can't ignore the commerce side of that. They're making ridiculous sums of money, and everybody wants that. But also what we see is that investing in these, like, massive movies is so risky when you can turn around and make a movie for way less money, and it's, you know, it could make you a ton of money. So it's the return on investment question. Mm. So, like, Universal Pictures in 2014 did not have one blockbuster film, but they made more money than they've ever made in the history of the studio.
Really?
Because they've, yes, because they've been making medium budget or low budget films and paying more attention to the kinds of films they're making, the quality of the films they're making. And not, they weren't worried for a little while anyway about, you know, trying to come up with this huge tentpole mega blockbuster. And I think that's because they learned their lesson with the Fast and the Furious, which was this little genre movie that made a bundle of money, and they went, whoa, how did that happen? And so I think they're focused on trying to find the next Fast and the Furious just as much as they're focused on how do we replicate the model success. Hmm. So, you know, Hollywood has an interesting future ahead of it, but I think you're always constantly dealing with the the battle between people up there who actually are intelligent, who actually pay attention, who actually are more than just trying to keep their jobs, they're trying to do their jobs, and the people who are just trying to keep their jobs. Gotcha. I've met both types, you know, and I have, more than once.
Now, you've also worked on some kind of, I guess, spinoffs in a way. You got to work on some of my favorite books, the Buffy books back in the days, yeah, when the show was still on the air. Did you have any I guess fond memories of that time? Was it pretty easy to write back then, or did you have a lot of loopholes you had to do since the show was still on and people didn't really know where characters are going
to
wind up?
Yeah, I mean, there are always, you know, you always have to jump through hoops. I do think that what helped me was the feedback from readers, because the publisher and the people at Fox knew that I was getting good feedback. And so later on in the process, I was allowed to get away with things that wouldn't have flown when I first started doing them. Probably the best and earliest example of that was they had started to do hardcovers because the books were doing really well. And I had done the first hardcover with Nancy Holder. It was a book called Immortal. But then right after that, I said, you know what I want to do? I want to do a novel about Spike and Drew in World War II killing potential slayers. And it doesn't have Buffy or any of the other characters in the TV series, just Spike and Drusilla. And when we were first doing them, there's no way they would have said yes to that. I mean, they just would have been like, are you out of your mind? Again, they wouldn't have thought that the franchise could stand straying away so far from the core formula, that you could have a novel that didn't have Buffy and Xander and Willow and Giles in it, you know? Mm-hmm. But that book was the most fun, probably, well, or close to, of all of the Buffy projects I worked on. It was just a blast. So yeah, I mean, the further you got into it, the more sort of leeway, I guess we had, but at the beginning there was not, you know, and it was really a narrow focused,
right,
you know, thing. And,
I remember it really taking me as a reader a while to kind of really get into being a fan of the show, to read the comics and get kind of that same love, because, you know, it took me a while to realize, oh yeah, the show has 44 minutes to get from A to B to tell this story, and the comic only has like 22 pages. So it's, you know, yeah, it always felt like, oh, there should have been more to it, but you don't really have the time and the luxury to really flesh out your stories like the show did. And when I put that math together in my head, then it made me actually enjoy the books that much more and appreciate them that much more.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about the novels, obviously, but I did do some of the comics, and the interesting thing about the comics is that, you know, I did a few sort of one-offs I did the Angel Monthly series, all, I guess we did 17 issues of it. But from the Buffy comics, you're right. Doing it in 22-page chunks is really difficult, which is why I actually think that the best one I did for them is a thing called The Blood of Carthage, which was 5 issues. And it was definitely structured more like one of the novels. And that was, I had a lot of fun with that one. But yeah, you know, it was a really interesting period. And I, no question in my mind, that first Buffy book led to so many things. The relationship I had with my editor at Pocket Books led to a a whole bunch of other original books that I did with them. It introduced me to so many other writers that I would become friendly with. It introduced me to members of the cast that I'd become friendly with. Amber Benson and I, she's one of my best friends in the world. She's like my little sister, and we did a thing called Ghosts of Albion together, which is like, Ghosts of Albion was a very early, Ghosts of Albion is an animated web series we did for the BBC in England. But it was very early web series, flash animation. But I think it holds up, and we had great cast. You know, we had Rory Kinnear, who's playing the Frankenstein monster on Penny Dreadful now. You know, we had, there's a whole bunch of great British actors in there. And that came from pursuing that very first Buffy book, and so many other things have come from over the years that I tell people all the time who are in creative businesses, you just have to pursue the things you're passionate about. You have to just, because you never know where they're going to lead. You know, if you want to do something that seems like it's not in your wheelhouse, but you're interested and you're passionate and you're excited about it, you should just do it, because you never know what the thing is going to be that leads to something better, something more interesting, and the relationships too.
And Amber's doing novels herself too now, isn't she?
Yeah, and again, I would say if Amber were on the line with us, she probably would say the whole thing worked sort of in the same way for her, which is that a friend of ours, we had a mutual friend who introduced us, invited us both to lunch in Los Angeles one time, and we got to talking, and then the next time I was out there, a bunch of us had dinner, and I found out that Amber wrote plays, and I said, well, I'm doing these Buffy comics. If you ever want to do one, let me know. I'd love to do one with you, which led to us doing three Willow and Tara comics together, which led to the BBC asking us if we wanted to create an original web series for them, which led to a publisher saying, hey, I'd like to do novels based on your web series, which led to me and Amber collaborating on three Ghosts of Albion novels, or two novels and a novella, which led to her writing she's on her eighth novel right now, solo. So all of these things kind of come organically from pursuing something that interests you.
Oh. Awesome.
It's kind of cool, the synergy of it all, kind of flowing right into one to the other, too.
Yeah, you really could make a flowchart of all of this and see how it, how it works. But yeah, so now it's, she and I have other things we'd like to do together at some point, and hopefully we will.
And yet another thing he's going to let us linger and wonder what he's talking about, because he can't talk about it yet.
Yeah.
Well, no, that one I can't talk about, just because it's not anything real yet. Just things we've talked about, The other things are things that are actually happening. I just can't tell you.
Right. And one more thing I do have for you. I did see that you, or I do remember that you were involved in the writing some of the books for She back in the 90s. And you did a couple issues of that Rikishi issue, right? The Rikishi series?
I have an interesting I don't talk about Billy and Crusade very much.
Really?
It ended very badly. Tom Stengoski and I were doing a bunch of work for him at the time, and I wrote a number of issues She and really enjoyed it. I can't remember which one was Rikishi, but I think I did that. I did a bunch of one shots and other things for him at the time. Let's just say that he still owes me money.
It sounds like the paychecks didn't clear quite so well, because I think that was towards the end of Crusade,
Well, you know, the thing is, what bothered me the most, and actually I will talk about it because I want to make a comparison. Mm-hmm. What bothered me the most was that Tom and I, originally, when we saw that the sales were, not great and things were not going well, we went to Billy and offered to cut our page rate. We volunteered to take less money but continue working. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, and it wasn't a ton of money. It wasn't even about the money. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. At the end, it was just sort of like, look, just pay us X and we'll just forget all about it. Every time I would see him, he would say, you didn't get that check? I'll take care of that for years. And I would bust his balls every time I saw him. And then I just stopped. It just wasn't worth it anymore. and I just, it just bothered me. If just once, it hadn't been, oh, the sort of pretend. Mm-hmm. If just once it had been, you know, dude, I just can't do it, then I would have been fine with it. I would have left it alone forever. Mm-hmm. The flip side of that is when all the shit was hitting the fan with Chaos Comics, mm-hmm. Brian Polito made absolutely certain that I got paid and that Tom got paid. You know, just, mm-hmm. you know, just like, and didn't, that was it. Just made sure that we got paid. And I think I remember hearing that that wasn't the case for everybody. I don't know. But I just, all I know is, you know, what you're left with. And, so I enjoyed working on She. There are some issues of that as I went back and looked at it that I think are pretty good for early. And I have to be honest, I mean, I read a lot of crappy comics. over the years, I could go back and point out things that, you know, that I think are pretty bad. You know, I sort of learned on the job over the years, and I never, because I was writing novels as my regular gig, I never was pursuing it as enthusiastically as I should have. I just am a comics reader. I've always loved them, and so always wanted to do various comics things. So I could go back through the sort of bibliography of comics I've done and say, you know, these are not bad, and these are pretty crappy, and you know.
I would put that one in the pretty good one, because as I was kind of doing some research on you before you came on, I was I stumbled upon that title on the list, and I do remember, like, it's been many years since I read it, but I do remember that book, like, really kind of after I read it, like, wow, that it really stuck with me. And you know, I've been reading comics for 20 plus years now, and so that sometimes that doesn't always happen, and now it's wanting me to go back and try to dig out and find those books, because I do remember that one having that impact and making the old wheels in my head turn and like, wow, I really like that story. So congrats on,
yeah, I mean,
on that one there.
Yeah, thanks. No, you know what, I enjoyed working on them, and I think they came out well, you know. You know, there are things that didn't come out as well, you know. One of the things that Tom and I got the most crap for is we are the guys who resurrected the Punisher as an angel weapon toting dead guy. And I have to say, you know, listen, that was a really interesting experience. And I stand by that Flourish miniseries, the first miniseries we did with the art by Bernie Wrightson. Nobody gave a crap about the Punisher when we did that.
That's true.
I mean, he had gone from having 3 monthly comics to having no monthly comics. Nobody cared about Punisher. And Joe Quesada came to us and said, you know, we're looking for something really different, really interesting with the Punisher. And, you know, we think we should, you know, just have him, you know, off himself and then come back from the dead somehow. And that was basically the marching orders. So we came up with that whole story. And what was really interesting about that miniseries that people don't get is that, you know, you guys know, you follow comics, you know,
right.
The miniseries pattern is usually that the first issue does huge numbers and the second issue does about half that much, and then it deteriorates by a certain percentage over the course of the rest of the miniseries, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
But with that miniseries, the third issue sold more than the second issue, and the fourth issue sold more than the third issue.
Wow.
Really?
And this is what Jimmy Palmiotti told me, and that was in the Marvel Knights days. He was in a position to know. So it was really interesting. We had people who hated it. I always think about that scene in Private Parts with Howard Stern, you know. Probably people who love him watch for, you know, listen for 2.5 hours, and people who hate him listen for 4 hours. and I felt like that was that Punisher miniseries. People who hated it bought it and read every issue, and people who loved it bought it and read every issue. But then we were supposed to do this Wolverine Punisher miniseries to follow it up. We had a plot for it. We had ideas for it, and it was really enthusiastic about it. And then we were told that Pat and Alvin Lee were supposed to do the art. And I've got nothing against those guys as artists. That stuff is not my style, but I recognize that they're good at what they do. But, you know, but basically the remit at that point was, yeah, we got Pat and Alvin Lee coming on, so you need to make this about robots. And if they could be sexy robots, if they could be a sexy robot, that would be better. And so basically we shoehorned that into our existing plot, and then went from there. And I basically lost all heart and interest in it at that point. And I think that shows. Now, Snigowski, if he were on here, would be screaming at me, because he still stands by that one too and says, no, that's really good. It came out really well. I'm sorry, buddy. It didn't. he's like my best friend. I'm just like, but I would say that if he were on the phone. I'm just, you know.
And luckily for your Punisher sake, they did turn him into like Frankenstein a few years ago too. So maybe
I told my local comics guy when that happened. I said, I'm so grateful. Who was that? Is that Remender? Was it Rick Remender?
I think it was.
I said to my comics guy, I said, I'm so grateful to Remender for doing this, because it made makes our version now the maybe the second most hated, or maybe the third, because many people don't remember that a few years before we brought him back from the dead, Marvel had the Punisher turn black.
That's right.
And I think didn't they have like
the Punisher was a
couple
black
different
guy
versions?
For a while.
Yeah.
Who knows? Like, but no. I don't mean that there was a black guy who was Punisher. I mean Frank Castle somehow was a black guy.
And it wasn't
like an Elseworlds or alternate universe or what if. It was in continuity in Marvel that somehow somebody had performed some kind of crazy surgery on him to make him African American. And so anybody who says that, who says anything negative about that first Punisher meeting that has to do with Bernie Wrightson can go back and read those issues when the Punisher was surgically altered to become a black guy. Enough said.
Right.
It sounds like that idea came out of that one episode of MASH where that one officer didn't want to be the blood. Didn't want the blood transfusion from a colored person.
Oh right.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I just remember reading it and thinking, really? Like, who approved this?
At least it was an alternate Earth, and it happened to be, Frank Castle was black on that one. That's viable, but yeah, he just wakes up like, oh, I guess I'm black today. Like Quantum Leap or something.
And the other thing is, look, I really do love that first Punisher miniseries we did, and I will say that I think that if it weren't Frank Castle and the people who were like crazy about Frank Castle, and again, everything we did was dovetailed with the continuity. We didn't say anything didn't happen. We just said it happened for reasons people didn't know. And we got to use Damon Hellstrom, and that was a real, cool thing for me too. So you can go back and look at stuff that, that I did. I did an X-Men annual, and that was dog shit. And there were things that were just, not good.
Well, I know it's getting late, and we don't want to take up any more of your time. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at my website, which is ChristopherColvin.com. I am on Facebook. I'm terrible at this stuff. I think it's Christopher Golden Author on Facebook. I'm there. And on Twitter, at Christoph, with a PH, no ER, because it's too long, at Christoph Golden.
Excellent. Well, for our 100th episode, we couldn't get any more golden than Christopher Golden as a guest. Again, we thank you for coming on, and until next week, where we're going to do our best of 2014, we bid everyone adieu.
The bad crowd you've been hanging out with is a science fiction club?
This has been a Weeby Geeks production.